I want to do, brethren, is I want to go through kind of an unusual sermon in one aspect today. In 2015, I gave a three-part sermon on the Middle East in prophecy and the King of the North, if you'll remember those. Now, obviously, Dofeniac Springs and Mobile haven't heard these, so this is kind of a continuation of that. The audio files are available on the New Orleans website for Dofeniac Springs in Mobile if you want to go back and listen to them. Or if you would prefer, I can give those to you live in the future. I'll let you guys determine whether you want to hear it live or not. But something happened about 3 weeks ago, and it largely went unnoticed by almost the entire world, and yet it has a pretty significant impact on us today, if we understand. Certainly most of the world, it was a non-event. I don't even remember it being in the newspapers here or on FoxNews.com or CNN. I don't even remember it being covered. Was a person in the church that turned me on to the fact that this event had happened. So I did some study on it to try and figure out what happened, and as a result of that, this out popped this sermon. So we'll see how it goes today. I wonder how many in the church took notice of it. January 22nd, 2019. Anybody here know what happened? Be interesting. We'll go through it today and see what happens. We've been told for years that we need to continue to watch the Middle East and Europe. A third of the Bible is prophecy. And when you look at the prophecies, a lot of those have to do with events that have already happened, but some of them have to do with events that will precede the return of Jesus Christ. As a result of that, and the very last scripture of the day we'll turn to, where it says, when you see the tree ripening, know that the fruit is about to appear on the tree and you need to be ready. So I want to do that today. I want to talk a little bit about something that occurred in the past couple of weeks. But before I get there and tell you what that is, I want to give you some background so that you'll understand the importance of this. I'd like to start in Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. And we'll break into the thought, starting in verse 3. I left my iPad at home, so my Bible today is my iPhone. So we'll see how I do with this. We're breaking into a vision that John saw. Now, imagine what it would be like to be given a vision. I've often wondered what it would be like to all of a sudden realize, all right, now this isn't normal. This isn't a regular dream. I'm being told something. And John was obviously seeing something in a vision. So breaking into this, this is what John saw. Revelation 17 and verse 3. So he, an angel, carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, and it had seven heads and 10 horns. Ever have odd dreams and you wake up and think, what was I dreaming about that? Well, this the angel is showing something that that angel wanted John to see. A beast, it had a woman riding on top of it, and it had seven heads, and on one of those heads it had 10 horns. Verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. And I want you to remember that, precious stones and pearls. We're going to come back to that in a little while. She was arrayed in scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So this lady that's riding this beast is not a good person. On her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Interesting way of dealing with this. John was impressed by this person. When it says marveled and in amazement, that actually is kind of in awe of. And you can understand that. If you see something, even if it's a bad thing, if it's a big thing, you can be in awe of it. Like that growing up in the Midwest when tornadoes would come through. You're scared of them, but you're in awe of them. And John was in awe of this. So John is impressed. And again, notice this woman had adorned with precious stones and pearls. Now go to verse 7. The angel said to John, why are you marveling at this? Why are you impressed with this? This is obviously not a good thing. I tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life. That was a kind of a slam onto John. You know, the people that are going to marvel at it are the people that don't know the truth. You, John, shouldn't be marveling at this. The other people are going to marvel at it because they're not going to understand what's going on. Don't be impressed with this. This is not a good thing. Whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. When they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. So there's some important information here. Whatever this beast is, it was active for a while. It was. It is not. So in the current state of affairs, it's not doing anything. But it will come back again. So whatever is happening here, it was active in the past, not doing anything right now, but it will occur in the future. Verse 9, here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Now, we'll come back to and talk more about the woman later on in the sermon. But go on into verse 10. And there are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is, and another is yet to come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. Now, remember, from John's perspective, this is all a future event. None of this has happened yet. This is John seeing a vision of something that's going to happen in the future. And the angel's starting to describe now what this means. This beast that has 7 heads. Those 7 heads are actually 7 kings. And we're going to be getting some more information as we go. Just prior to uniting of a final king, this group of people will come together. And in this vision, John says that there would be 7 successive kings over this beast, the same world-ruling empire. He was told that 5 had already come and gone. The 6th was current but not doing much, but that there was one yet to come, and this one to come was going to be a doozy. And that's what I'm going to spend the majority of my time talking about today. Now, in church history, and for those of you that have been around for a while and have seen this, you'll know that the church has taught for years that when we talk about King of the North, we're talking about a European Union. We would call that the Holy Roman Empire. And the King of the South will be a confederation of Arab states that come together under a caliphate. And if you've studied history in the past, you know that there have been a lot of caliphates that have come into the Middle East in the past. And that there have been a lot of resurrections, as it were, of the Holy Roman Empire. What I want to do today, just to kind of whet your appetite a little bit, is I want to show you some slides. I want to bring them up today. Marlis and I had the chance, if I can get the... So Marlis and I had a chance to go to France 1 year for the feast, and then after the feast, we rented a car, and so we flew into Paris, but we flew out of Vienna, Austria, and we went through Germany, and Austria, Slovakia, Bulgaria. We got to visit a lot of places. In Vienna itself, we got to tour this facility. Just to give you a little bit of background, this is the Hofburg Imperial Palace. Now, that may not mean anything to you, but this was the seat of the Holy Roman Empire for hundreds and hundreds of years. The Habsburg dynasty, this was their winter palace where they lived. I want to read just a little bit about this and show you a few pictures. The House of Habsburg, also called the House of Austria, was one of the most influential and distinguished royal families of Europe. The throne of the Holy Roman Empire was continuously occupied by a Habsburg from 1438 until their extinction in 1740 when the last male heir died. This palace was at one time the winter residence of the emperor, and it's now the office of the President of Austria. And it contains 3 museums. And if you go through these museums, you will see the history of the Holy Roman Empire. Marlis and I got to tour that. Absolutely fascinating. Similar in scope to going through the Vatican, if any of you have ever done that, and seen the history of the Catholic Church through the artwork and through the opulence of the jewelry and things that they have there, you will see in this place as well. And if you will, I'd like to show you just a couple of things from some of these three museums here, because it talks about the history of the Holy Roman Empire and how that will play into prophecy in the future. So I want to show you a couple of things. First of all, I want you to notice, and it will be a little hard for you to see in this picture, but right above the door, all the way up on the roof of the building in front of the green cupola, is this crown. I want you to remember, look at that crown and get a picture of it, because I'm going to show you another picture of it here pretty soon. This crown is above the doorway or the entryway of the palace. This crown is a replica of the actual crown that the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, would wear. And we got to within a couple of feet of it, and I had some really good pictures of it, and I'll show you that in just a minute. But the idea, again, behind this was Europe would unite under a king or an emperor, and that emperor would rule over the entirety of the realm that he was over at the time. When you go in and you look at this, here's just an example of the opulence of it. This is one of the smaller ones. This is the dining room, what you would set the salt and pepper shakers in the middle. This is probably 8 or 9 feet long. This was the small one. They had one there that I had a picture of it, but I just decided not to show it just because you can't see any detail. It probably is 35 or 40 feet long, and it's for one table. I had to take it as a, you know, how you can set your camera up as a motion thing and start at one end and go this way to try and get it into a picture. There are dozens of these all around. The amount of gold, the amount of precious jewels, the amount of opulence that's in this area is reminiscent of a way in going through the Vatican when you see that. And it's very, very much similar to that. Deeply tied to the Catholic faith, I just will show you one example here. And it's a little hard to see, but on the right-hand side here it says a reliquary, a box to store things in, is basically what that word means, containing a piece of the tablecloth from the Last Supper. Now, most historians would say that's not accurate, but they believe that. They have, and you can see them in there, they have a nail from the crucifixion. In fact, they know, that this is their interpretation of it, they know that it was the nail that was in the right hand of Jesus Christ on the cross. They have bits of the cross. They have a piece of the loincloth that Jesus Christ wore. They have a tooth of St. Peter. They have a tooth of John the Baptist. And all of these religious artifacts are there. They also have statuary there that you'll see in a little while may play into some miracles that will happen in the future. A lot of information that was there is tied very closely to the Catholic Church, which makes sense. If you look back at what happened prior to the Catholic Church getting involved, there were people that were trying to control Europe, but it was very hard to do because there wasn't this power behind to try and give it its effect. When the Holy Roman Empire came, the Pope would crown the emperor, and now the emperor had power and had an army, but he also had the backing of the church. And so during this period of time, this power, this Holy Roman Empire, would have the backing of the Catholic Church in Europe, and it was very, very powerful. So the emperor would set up in this area and would have all of these relics, would have all of these things to look at, would have the background of the papacy, and was fully entrenched in power. Something that I found interesting, and I took a picture of this just to show it to you, perhaps some of you didn't realize this, the emperor used to perform foot washing every year on Holy Thursday. If you know what Holy Thursday is, for those of you that have been in this area, you probably know what I mean. Holy Week, there's always something that happens every day of the week on Holy Thursday before Good Friday. They would go get peasants, poor peasants, and they would bring the peasants in, and there would be a series of men and a series of women, and the emperor himself would wash the feet of the men, and the duchesses would wash the feet of the women. They would separate them, very much like we would do Passover service today. And they would give them a meal, And then they would give them coins, and after the meal was over, they would send them home, and they would, have a couple of whatever their coins were from the Roman Empire to help them throughout the next year. But this is the basin in which they would put the feet in, and then they would pour the water, and then the emperor would kneel down and do this. When you look at the things that the emperor would do, you would realize, and going through these museums, you would realize just how tied the emperor was to the office of the pope. Very connected, and that will play an important part in a little bit. But now what I want to do is show you the crown itself. So this is the crown. This is the crown that the Holy Roman Emperor wore. Most of the kings of the Romans, kings of the Romans is what they were called, of the Holy Roman Empire, wore this crown. An identical copy of this is in a town in Germany, A-A-C-H-E-N, Aachen. I want you to remember that, because that's going to come into play in just a little while. But this is the actual crown, and it is in a museum in the Habsburg Imperial Palace in Vienna. Just waiting for another person to put it on one of these days. I want to describe this to you. I think it's interesting. Most crowns that kings or emperors wore were round. This one is not. It is eight-sided, octagonal. If you go back to the sermon that I did on pagan holidays, it was eight-sided and it was hinged. You actually could unhinge this and lay it flat to clean it or do whatever, and then would put it back in a hinge. There are 144, interesting number, precious stones and as many pearls. Remember I read earlier that the woman that rode the beast had precious stones and pearls. That is completely decked out in this. If you look at the image itself, there are four plates that have pictures on it, and you can see one of the plates on the right side. So it's a plate with an image, and then precious stones, an image, precious stones. It goes all the way around. Of the four plates, one of them is Christ in majesty between two cherubim with the inscription, "By me, kings reign." So you're going to see the symbolism of what they're saying. In other words, by me, by the authority of the church, I'm allowed to be emperor. I'm allowed to reign. So they're tying the crown of the emperor to the church so that the church actually gives it its power. The woman rides the beast. The second one is the prophet Isaiah speaking to Hezekiah, saying, "Behold, I will add 15 years to your life." In other words, God save the king, God save the emperor. The emperor will be allowed to live and to reign. The third one is of King Solomon, and has the inscription under it. It says, "Fear the Lord and flee from evil." And then the fourth is King David, saying, "The renowned king delights in doing justice." On the other four plates, there are two plates have 12 stones that represent the 12 stones on the high priest's breastplate. If you remember back in ancient Israel, the high priest would wear a breastplate that had 12 stones, and each of those stones represented one of the nations of Israel. And then they also have throughout this, and you can see them there, they have just hundreds and hundreds of small pearls on there. They call them seed pearls. I don't know if you know what a seed pearl is, but they're very, very small. There is a ribbon that connects front to back. You see the cross in the front, and then there's a ribbon that connects front to back. In seed pearls is letters. It's written in Latin. And translating it into English, one of them says, "The emperor of the Romans and of Augustus," and the other talks about, again, the ruling of the king through the power of the papacy. Now I want to go back, and I'll just kind of leave this picture up here for a while. I want to go back to verse 10. We are in Revelation chapter 17 anyway. Let's go back and read verse 10 again. It says, let's go back to verse 9. "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits." Seven mountains meaning seven nations or groups of people. So the woman would rule over these nations. Verse 10, it says, "There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and one is yet to come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space." That crown is in that place right now where there have been five rulers. You talk about the various rulers of the past that have ruled over the Holy Roman Empire. There was a one that was for a while. It started with Garibaldi and Mussolini and Hitler. They tried to get this Holy Roman Empire thing going. Remember, it says that five were, one is, but it's not really doing much. That's that period of time. But there still is one yet to come. And that crown is sitting there waiting for someone to put it on today. Drop down to verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have yet to receive a kingdom. So if you think about this picture of this beast, and I probably should have put a picture up. I did in, when I gave the King of the North sermon. But you have a beast, and there are seven heads, and then that last head had ten crowns on it, ten horns and ten crowns. So this last king, or this last head of the beast, is going to have ten kings that will rule over it. And it says they haven't received their power yet, but they will for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So there will be a person that will be over the Holy Roman Empire, and then under him will be ten rulers. Now, I want to describe something about this because, again, if you don't read Greek or Hebrew, sometimes it's hard to understand what some of these things says. I want to remind you of Matthew 24 and verse 7. Won't necessarily turn back there. But you remember when Jesus Christ was doing the Olivet prophecy and he talked about there would be wars and rumors of wars. He said that nation would rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Why mention them both? Those are two completely different words in the Greek. Nation against nation, the word for nation is ethnos. It was a specific group of people would be against a specific group of people. And you can see that. All throughout Europe is like that. The Slovaks are very, very different from the French, who are very different from the Danish, who are very different from the Italians. Those nations that are there are ethnos. They are a specific group of people. Very hard for one group to trust another, and we'll talk about that in just a while. So it says nation will rise against nation. In other words, there'll be an ethnic group fighting an ethnic group. But then it says that there will be kingdom against kingdom. That word is basileus, and it means a literal person, a sovereign, that will rule over a nation or a group of nations. So when we talk about in Revelation 17 here in verse 11, 12, 13, when it says that these are kings and they're over a kingdom, this is basileus. This isn't the word ethnos. We're talking about a literal ruler, a king, and you'll see how this plays. How many kings do we have out there right now? Look throughout Europe. How many kings are there? There's a king of Thailand, but that's not in Europe. The Europe is democratic right now. They have courts and they have prime ministers and they have this, but this is different. This is talking about a king. And that king, the leader of the Holy Roman Empire, is going to have 10 kings under him. Something's going to happen that will drive them back to a system of having a leader over them that's more like a king. Verse 13, they will be of one mind, and they will give their authority, their power, and their authority to the beast. How will that come about? They're not there now. We got a lot of nations. Sometimes we look at the European Union of 28 states and think, well, out of this has got to pop up this this Holy Roman Empire. But it's not there, and it's not in that place right now. We have sometimes said that 10 kings are of 10 nations. Now, if you look back at what we have said in the past, right now there are 28 member states. I've heard people say in the past, we need to knock that down to 10. No, this doesn't say there will be 10 ethnos, 10 nations. This says 10 kings. It doesn't have to be 10 nations. It just has to be 10 rulers over this area. It could be a lot more nations than that. Who knows? But what we're going to end up with is an emperor that will have 10 kings under him ruling Europe. They will be of one mind, at least for a while, but they will only rule for a short time. To me, this speaks of an emergency, and I think you're going to see that in just a little while of things that have happened just in the last couple of years. Europe is in a crisis stage right now, and they're looking to try and figure out how to fix some problems that they've been having. They've had a lot of immigration problems. They opened their doors to people coming in from the Middle East, and that didn't go so well. And now they're trying to figure out what to do now that they've got some people in their country that they're not sure they want anymore. So there's some problems that they're having. And we'll talk about those problems in just a moment. Verse 14. These, the beast power with 10 kings, will make war with the Lamb. So, again, I won't go back to what I talked about with the sermon on the King of the South and the King of the North, but we know that this beast power will eventually end up going down into the Holy Land. They're going to fight against the King of the South. And while in the Holy Land, the return of Jesus Christ will occur. He'll come back to the Mount of Olives. And we know that these armies that are there will turn around and will try and fight the returning Jesus Christ. These will make war with the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. He's the real Basileos. He's the one that's going to take it over. And those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So after fighting the King of the South, this Holy Roman Empire emperor and his kings and his armies will turn and fight the returning Christ. Now, I want you to save your place here because we're going to come back to this, but I want to go back to Daniel chapter 2 and read something that Daniel was able to see again in a vision about this same period of time. Daniel saw the vision of this image, and it had head of gold, right, which was Nebuchadnezzar, and it had the chest of silver and the thighs of brass. But when you get down into the legs and the feet, I want to read what it says about this here. This describes this same period of time, these 10 kings. I'm again breaking into the thought, but it says, whereas you saw the feet and toes, so how many toes are there? It's five on one foot, five on another, and it says that earlier, that there are 10 toes. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, they were partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. Because the kingdom, again, not the ethnos, this is talking about something different, the kingdom would be divided. Yet the strength of the iron will be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with clay. And as the toes on the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom will be partly strong and partly fragile. When you have a bunch of, and I'm going to use the Greek terms again, a bunch of ethnos that come under a Basileus, there's going to be problems. Because ethnic peoples have their own backgrounds. They have their own culture. Marlis and I, when we drove through there, it was amazing. You drive through Austria, and it's gorgeous. They have all of these beautiful vines, and the houses are painted really pretty. And you cross over into Slovakia, and it's like going back to 1950s black and white television. There's no color. All the buildings are gray. Everything. Nothing is painted. They're just a different mindset. They don't see the need to paint a house. Yet you go through Switzerland, and not only are the houses painted, but every window's got a flower box in it. I mean, they're just different. They just think different. So, yes, there will be 10 kings under a ruler, but they're never going to completely gel. They'll give their power and their authority to the beast for a reason, but they're never going to completely gel. Verse 43, as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they won't adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, these 10 kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. Remember, we saw that in Revelation. Jesus Christ will return, and they will fight against him. All right, so let's go back to Revelation chapter 17 again. If I can get back there myself on this, on my iPhone. Give me a minute here. Revelation chapter 17. And let's go back to verse 15 and continue to read. So again, from what we saw in Daniel, yes, there will be 10 kings. They will be acting as one, but they'll never fully congeal. There's always going to be a problem. Verse 15. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, ethnos, and tongues. It's hard to get a group of people like that together. When you don't speak the same language, when you have a different culture, they're over this group, but they're so diverse, they never really truly gel. But why would they come together in the first place? I wonder. We'll read some interesting things here. I think you'll see. I hope that you'll see this is interesting. Verse 16. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot. So the very thing that gave them its power, this religious power behind it, they will end up hating the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God, verse 17, has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And then once the word of God is fulfilled, they'll end up turning on each other. The cohesion won't last, and finally they'll end up destroying each other, as it were. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So the woman is the city, Rome, that rules over the nations of the earth. And you can go all the way back to Charlemagne and others that were ruled over by the papacy. The Pope gave them their power. So the woman atop the beast will guide this end-time king who will be a ruler or an emperor over 10 kings. And then God will allow this final union, but we also will see that there will be problems within it, cracks in it, and eventually the papacy will be destroyed. That actually has happened a couple of times in history as well, if you realize. The papacy would set up the Holy Roman Emperor, but then the emperor would rebel against the authority of the Pope. And a couple of times the papacy became very weak because of the strength of the Holy Roman Emperor. And we'll see that happen again. So at some point in time, we will see a single ruler that will assume the mantle of the Holy Roman Empire, and 10 leaders or 10 kings will be set up and will give their authority over to this last emperor, but they'll never truly gel. So what does all this mean for us today? That was just a little history lesson. What does that mean for us today, and what happened on January 22nd, 2019 that may be of significance that the rest of the world missed? In order for us to understand what happened on January 22nd, I want to go back to World War II, to 1939, when Germany was, when France and Britain declared war on Germany. Now, if you think about all of the groups that are in the European Union now, Poland, Austria, Slovakia, Denmark, Netherlands, France. These were all on one side or another of what's going to happen in World War II. France and Britain declared war on Germany in 1939. Within a few months, Germany had invaded and conquered and occupied France. And France and Germany were bitter enemies for years. France was under Germany's rule for the next 5 years. When the war ended in 1945, there was a huge distrust, obviously, between France and Germany. Most of you probably realize this, but when the war was over and Germany was divided into two, a part of it was given to the Western powers, the United States, Britain, etc. Part of it was given to the Eastern powers, the Soviet Union. And the United States ended up bankrolling Germany, and within a few months, if not a couple of years, Germany was back almost to full power because we provided them money to be able to do that. Most of you don't realize it, but that really irritated the French. Charles de Gaulle was absolutely livid with the United States because we kept funneling money in to rebuild their enemy. They absolutely hated Germany. When the war ended, the distrust between France and Germany continued. But post-war Germany rebuilt, and it took years and years and years for the distrust to finally end. In fact, it took 18 years. But something happened on January 22nd, 1963. Now, this is not this January 22nd, but January 22nd, 1963. Things started to turn around. But because France and Germany signed a treaty, the Élysée Treaty. And I don't know if you've ever even heard of that. The Champs-Élysées, the road that goes down the middle of Paris. The Élysée Treaty was signed January 22nd, 1963. I want to read the preamble of this. The treaty reads this: The two governments of France and Germany will consult each other prior to any decision on all important questions of foreign policy. And because of this, France and Germany, as the ice started to thaw, whenever Germany would make a decision, they would talk to France about it first. Whenever France would make some type of policy decision, they would talk to Germany. And slowly, they started to form this Franco-German relationship again. And now they're not enemies anymore. In fact, they're the two closest of all of the European, all the 28 European nations. France and Germany are now the two closest together, where 50 years ago, they were bitter enemies and hated each other. Because of this, representatives of both nations meet regularly to discuss foreign policy. So the freeze has thawed. France and Germany are now facing, as I said, another crisis. And this time, they're in lockstep with each other. I've got an article. I'm going to read a little bit from an article here, actually a couple of articles. This one is called Germany and France Renew Their Vows, But Challenges Remain. This was put out January 22, 2019. This is from the New York Times. Talks about this first treaty. It says, when it was originally signed in 1963, in the long wake of World War II, and with the Cold War deepening, the Élysée Treaty served to reconcile Germany and France and establish their relationship as, and I'm quoting, an indispensable stage on the way to a united Europe. When Europe started to gel back in the 1960s, when the EU, remember it started out as the EEC, a European Economic Community, then became a European Union, it was France and Germany that were trying to drive that together. Where just a few years earlier, because of World War II, they were bitter enemies, they now were starting to recognize, no, we need for you. The Soviet Union has got missiles that they're going to fire over our heads to get to England. And the United States has got missiles that they're going to fire over our head to try and get to the Eastern Bloc. And we're defenseless. World War II wiped us out, and we've got to do something to try and become a power again. Where do you think that power is going to come from? So Germany and France became these two nations that were the ones that were instrumental in trying to unite Europe. And it started in earnest in 1963 when they signed this treaty. All right, now enter some of the things that have happened just within the last year or two. You all know about Brexit, where Britain is now trying to get out of the EU. Of the 28 nations, everybody in Europe is watching what's going to happen with Britain. Why are they doing that? The EU, at times, to us maybe seems like a steamroller that is just more and more nations are being gobbled up into it, more and more ethnos, more and more of these different peoples are being gobbled up into it. But again, if you think about how Daniel described it, part of iron and part of clay, they're having trouble getting themselves together. And what's happened over the last few years is these various nations, these ethnos, has elected prime ministers, and the prime ministers are being elected on populism or on nationalism. We want Italy to be separate from the rest of Europe. Denmark, we want to be separate from the rest of Europe. We want the good part of Europe, but we don't want anybody telling us what to do. The ethnos are rising up against the Basileus. The European Union wants to set up kings. The ethnos that's in the area is rejecting that. So with Brexit, all of these nations are now starting to watch what's going on with Britain. Ethnic roots, again, run very, very deep. There are several nations that are watching how Britain is going to exit the EU, and many countries are now watching it because they don't want their nations, their ethnos, to be under an EU's Basileus or king. These include, and you may find this interesting, Italy, Austria, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, Denmark, and Finland. They all want out. And they're watching Brexit to see how to do it, or probably more correctly, how not to do it, because Britain really goofed this one up bad as they're trying to get out of the EU. So remember, the ethnos versus the Basileus, that's going to run deep. France and Germany are really the only two that are staunchly against nationalism, and they're desperately trying to keep this EU alive. Imagine that. The two mortal enemies are now fighting for the very thing that France despised a few decades earlier. Now I want to show you this last picture here. This is what happened on January 22nd of this year. I want to read a little more about this. This, again, is from this New York Times article. On Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019, Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany and President Emmanuel Macron of France met in a German city symbolic to both. Aachen, remember I said that earlier, where a replica of the crown is. This was the room that they signed this in, was the room of Charlemagne, one of the first Holy Roman Emperors. This was very specific. They went to this room to re-sign a treaty to try and strengthen the EU. This happened just 3 weeks ago. To renew the commitment for the 21st century in a ceremony that nevertheless served as a reminder of the daunting array of challenges that threaten Europe today. What's threatening Europe? Well, we read a little more about this. The leaders and their countries, former enemies who lost millions in wars in the last century, formed the staunchly pro-Europe core of the continent. But with Mrs. Merkel already on a glide path out of power and Mr. Macron severely weakened by popular protests at home, their simultaneous decline is threatening to leave a crater at the center of Europe's decade-old project of unity. So these two people came back to sign what amounts to the Élysée Treaty 2.0 to renew their vows to try and put a strong Europe together. But they're having problems with it. Now, problems are many. Let's read about some of those problems. Internal and external forces continue to raise the prospect of fracturing the European Union. Britain is scheduled to leave on March 29th. That's a crack in the European Union, and it's worrying them because all these other nations are watching. So there's one crack. The Trump administration is threatening tariffs and questioning Washington's commitment to NATO. In fact, our president went over to the European Union and told them, you need your own military because we're tired of being your military for you. Imagine that, the very power that's going to end up taking over and ruling Europe. Our president is saying, you need to build a military. So, but how can they build a military when they're fracturing? This treaty is trying to get started the roots of having a military power in Europe because President Trump is pulling money away. He's telling them instead of putting 1% or 2% of your gross domestic product into a military, it needs to be 10, 15, 20%. We're tired of doing this for you. Populist governments in Hungary and Poland are challenging fundamental principles of liberal democracy and the rule of law, and Italy is challenging traditional liberal values. Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Macron are sending a very strong signal. At a time when nationalism is gaining more and more ground in Europe, in other words, the ethnos is becoming more and more powerful, the two are renewing the vow to cooperate and to unify. Even though they can't stop Brexit and they can't ban populism, they are showing what Europe is supposed to look like and how it's supposed to work. The French-German friendship has served as the backbone to the European Union as it grew from a predominantly economic alliance of Western Europe to now include a political bloc of 28 countries stretching across Europe. So it started out as an agreement of economy. It then became a political bloc. Now it's going to try and form into a military bloc. It's getting stronger and stronger and stronger as it goes. And yet, they keep having problems. The iron won't mix with clay. They're just not going to be able to get this together. Something has to happen to cause it to be able to get together. Something has to happen where someone's going to stand up and say, we need a strong arm. We need someone. The United States isn't there anymore. They're not helping us. We've got to do this on our own. When this relationship, commonly referred to as the Franco-German marriage, remains vital to the continent's future, critics see a relatively weak renewal of vows, and it risks angering many of the countries that the smaller European partners, again, because of the problems that they're having. Going on, 74 years after the end of World War II, a lifetime. There's nobody around anymore that was there during World War II. When my parents were alive, my dad used to talk about the dangers, and Dad, my dad wasn't a part of the church, didn't have any religious background at all. In fact, I would consider my dad an atheist. But he saw Germany as a threat to the rest of the world, and for all of his life he did. But that group of people is no longer around. So 74 years after the end of World War II, and this article says a lifetime for those people that are there now, things considered self-evident are again being called into question. That is why we need first, and this is Angela Merkel talking, a reestablishment of the responsibility of Germany and France within the European Union, and second, we need to reorient our cooperation. Reorient meaning start heading toward a military, and you'll see that here in a minute. The new accord, so this January 22nd, 2019, this new accord includes pledges to deepen the economic integration through a joint economic zone, but also to start military purchasing with the coordination and aim of improving Europe's ability to act on its own. So this is a first. Now, they've talked about military prowess in the past, but have never been able to do anything about it. January 22nd, 2019, that changed. Now they've got a treaty in place that says we need to start building a military, and that's now going to start happening. Something's going to happen. We know, again, if you look at what the Bible says, where the king of the south pushes against the king of the north, there's going to be a reason for them to have to use this military. Both Mr. Macron and Ms. Merkel have called in their own ways for a European army capable of acting alone when NATO does not wish to get involved, NATO and the United States. All right, let me figure out where I am in my notes here. Hang on a second. So why would Europe need a military force? Well, when you look on, the position of the United States and you look at the position of NATO, they're saying, look, the Cold War's over. You don't need to worry about Russia shooting missiles at us or us shooting missiles at Russia. But now they've got this problem of the integration of people that are coming into the area that are causing problems, suicide bombers, the whole thing that they've got to work with, and the United States is saying you got to take care of yourself. We're not going to do this anymore. In fact, I want to read one more article, and then this is the last article that I'll read. This is the title of this is President Trump is getting the European army he wanted. Donald Trump may be unhappy with Europe, but he can't blame the Europeans for listening to him. You know, when you go to Europe and say I'm cutting your money off, you need to protect yourself. What are they going to do? They're going to start an army. Well, when they did that, then President Trump was saying, well, now, wait a minute. We don't want you to be armed. Well, you can't have it both ways. I mean, if you're going to pull support and money, they're going to have to do it themselves. Macron, this is again from the second article, Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel desire to build a European army, which is a reflection that the continent has woken to the reality that it needs to stand on its own two feet instead of relying on the U.S. for its security. And that's exactly what President Trump said that he wanted. With the European election looming on the horizon, Macron wants to prove that a united, strong Europe can protect itself. 2 years after the surprise election in the United States, Europeans are starting to take the U.S. president seriously and literally. They have abandoned the hope that President Trump is a passing fad and recognize that with his personal relation and his attenuated policies, they need to build a European defense. So the reason for this Élysée 2.0 treaty to try and call for a European army. Macron's push for a European army fits into this larger effort. With the European election looming on the horizon, the French president again wants a strong EU. That includes making a case for shared borders, pooling defense efforts, promoting common trade, which will make Europe more powerful on the world stage. The goal of all of this is a Europe that can defend itself on its own without depending on the United States or any other sovereign, any other basilios. They want to be able to take care of this themselves. Europeans, in short, have awakened to a security issue. Russian aggression against the Ukraine, ISIS-inspired terror attacks in Europe, refugee crisis as a result of the collapse of Syria and Libya have reminded Europe of its previous complacency on security matters. So again, just to give you an idea of what happened 3 weeks ago, The decision was made that the EU needs to go from economic to political to military, and you'll start to see that build. So where does this leave us today? There are 28 member nations right now, ethnos, different ethnic groups that make up the EU. From this group, there has to arise 10 kings under one overall ruler. We've long believed and taught that Britain would not be a part of it, since we obviously believe that Britain is a part of Israel, a part of the lost 10 tribes, and that the 10 tribes wouldn't be a part of the European Union. Will nationalism and other member nations cause more than just Britain to leave? What will it take to bring 10 kings together under a Roman emperor? I wanted to discuss this. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 13, and let's read what it is that causes this power to get started. Revelation chapter 13, starting in verse 1. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on its 10 horns were 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Same beast rising up out of the sea. 7 heads and 10 horns and 10 crowns are these 10 kings. What's going to bring them together? Look at verse 2. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and his authority. So who is going to be the overall ruler of this resurrected Holy Roman Emperor? The dragon. Keep your place here. Go back to Revelation chapter 12, just a few verses earlier, in verse 9. If you're not sure who this dragon is. Verse 9 of Revelation 12. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan that deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So who will be in charge of this next iteration of the Holy Roman Empire? It will be Satan the devil, and he will be the one that will put it together. It says that the dragon gives him 3 things: power, a throne, and authority. Again, that crown is sitting there and ready to be used by the next emperor that comes. So one of the things will happen is that Satan, in his final push to try and destroy this earth, is going to help revive this last Holy Roman Emperor. Go back to Revelation 13 again, and let's continue in verse 3 and 4. And I saw one of its heads as it had been mortally wounded, but the deadly wound was healed. You go back and look at the Holy Roman Empire was completely crushed. In fact, if you remember me saying it, the last male heir was killed so that there couldn't be another emperor arise. And it seemed like the Holy Roman Empire completely died out. But there still are relatives of relatives of relatives, and they know who they are. There are barons that are out there that are still a part of this family. Something will happen that will bring them back. I saw the deadly wound, and the world marveled and followed the beast. Verse 4, so they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who's able to make war with him? When this finally gets going, it is going to be such a powerful force that the world will be in awe of it. And it will be a force more powerful than anything that anyone will have seen up to that time. So two things will bring these 10 kings together under this last ruler. One of them is Satan the devil will possess into this last Holy Roman Empire. Let's look at the second thing that will happen, Revelation 13, verse 11. We talked about that earlier. Then I saw another beast come up out of the earth, and it had 2 horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. A lamb being like Jesus Christ, but spoke like a dragon, Satan the devil. This is a false church. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those that dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. What does this other power do? He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth and in the sight of men. and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. Verse 15, and he, this power, was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now, a lot of symbolism here. I'm not telling you that I completely understand exactly what's going to happen, but here's a scenario that has been talked about. You remember how in ancient times God told ancient Israel, don't make an image. And they did anyway. It would appear that there will be another image made that will be representative, a representation of the Holy Roman Emperor himself. And that this image, they'll be able to do miracles. This great religious power will be able to do miracles that can even make the image speak. If you've seen or heard some of the quote-unquote miracles that have been done in the past where images started weeping or blood would come out of their eyes or whatever, those are miracles that happen in the face of Satan the devil. We know that he will have his power behind it, but we also know from what we read here that there will be a religious power that will be behind it too, causing miracles. Verse 16, he will cause all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads so that they can't buy or sell unless they have the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So a revival of this religious system that has long been the united force behind Europe will happen again. So Satan will get behind an emperor. The papacy or the power of the Catholic Church in Europe, which is very strong, will get behind it as well. There will be miracles that will happen. A champion will arise as Europe is being pushed by its own internal struggles, as well as what we know will be a king of the South. As Europe is being pushed by the South, a champion will arise backed by 10 kings. They will be under the influence of Satan and in the presence of miracles produced by this great religious power. And as it says here, the world will marvel. Be an interesting time to come. Where's the United States in all of this, right? If you read through the prophecies in the Old and New Testament, the United States is nowhere to be seen. I don't have the time to go through that now. Again, I've given sermons on this in the past, this time of Jacob's trouble. But we know that the United States is not going to be a player in this next world war. This is going to be a European theater. And it will be something that they will deal with by themselves. Now, I want to read something to you. When I read this, it made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And I missed this as well, I'll be honest with you. This was an interview that the Pope did with La Repubblica, which is an Italian newspaper, in 2016. So this is 2.5 years old. But this is quoting now. I actually went and looked at the, even in Italian, which I don't read Italian, but you can Google a site and then hit the translate button and it'll translate what's being said in another language. And here's what Pope Francis discussed with this paper. It says, Pope Francis' idea is that Americans would be better off under a world government. And all of a sudden, you've got, oh boy. All right, now this is getting serious. The pontiff also went on to record stating that Europe should become one country under one government. In that same interview, according to La Repubblica, Pope Francis said that Europe must take on a federal structure, resembling feudal times when the peasants were ruled by an unimpeachable monarch. Now, how are they ruled right now? They're ruled by prime ministers and right. They're ethnos. They're nations that have their What this is saying is we need to push aside the ethnos and we need to have a basileus. We need to have an unimpeachable monarch rule Europe. That's what the Pope is calling for. He's being quoted here directly. I also thought many times to this problem and came to the conclusion that Europe must, as soon as possible, become a federal structure, become a basileus. So even back in 2016, the Pope was saying if Europe ever truly wants to unite, they have to get rid of this nationalism. They have to get rid of the ethnos. And they have to install an emperor. They have to install a king again. That's what they're waiting for. Remember again, let's go back to Daniel chapter 11. What it says will happen toward the end. Daniel Where's Daniel? Daniel chapter 11. And let's start in verse 40. If you have the same Bible I do, above verse 40, it says, the king of the north's conquest. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south, this conglomerate of nations from the south, the Arabic states, will attack him. So the king of the south is going to come together and attack the king of the north. And the king of the north will call the United States and ask for help. No, that's not a part of this. He's going to take care of his own because they will have, by this time, a military of their own. The king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and ships. And he will enter the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. This is the same king of the north will also enter the glorious land. That's the Holy Land. Many countries will be overthrown. But Edom, Moab, and Ammon, that's the nation of Jordan right now, will escape. Verse 43, and he will have power over the treasuries of gold and silver, over the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north will trouble him. Therefore, he will go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he will plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountains. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Again, the iron won't mix with clay. They'll be strong, but they won't be able to get it done. And in the face of that, they will be pushed by foreign powers, not only the king of the south, but news out of the north and the east. And how will it finally end? Revelation chapter 19. Let's read what happens to this beast power. Revelation 19 and verse 17. Again, the heading over verse 17 says, the beast and his armies defeated. Then I saw an angel stand in the sun, verse 17, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses and those who sit on them, and the flesh of the peoples, both slave and free, small and great. Verse 19, and I saw this beast, the kings of the earth and their armies. So this beast, this emperor, and those 10 kings that are with him and their armies, gathered together to make war against him, capital H, Jesus Christ, who sat on the horse and against his army. Verse 20, and when the beast was captured and with him the false prophet, so the leader of this end time religious work, the false prophet, the leader of this end time Holy Roman Emperor, the emperor himself, the beast and the false prophet who worked signs and miracles in his presence by which he deceived those with the mark of the beast, these two were cast alive into the lake of fire, and the rest were killed with a sword which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. The final emperor of the Holy Roman Empire will be defeated along with those kings. And the emperor himself and the false prophet, the head of this end-time religious organization, will be cast into the lake of fire. So when's it going to happen? Well, a lot of people out there will tell you, they'll try and give you a date, and the date will come and go. Obviously, we can't set dates. We don't know when this is going to happen. But I'd like to leave you with four thoughts today. Four thoughts, something that we should all be watching, so that when the next January 22nd, 2019 happens, maybe we'll see it. Here's the first one. I'd like for you to closely watch how member nations react after Brexit is finalized. What's going to happen to all of these nations, all of these 28 nations that are out there, these ethnos? What's going to happen to them? Look for other nations, possibly related to the lost 10 tribes of Israel. Denmark, Finland, and Sweden are in that group. I don't think they're going to be in it because they are a part of the lost tribes of Israel, just like England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland is. I think you'll see several of those pull out. Watch closely how other nations react to Brexit. Will nationalism grow, or will something happen that will cause, as the Pope said, we have got to get out of this nationalism and we have got to get a king. We've got to get an emperor. Watch what happens after Brexit is finalized. Something is going to happen following Britain's leave that will help France and Germany align. Is there a split coming in Europe? There could very well be because of all of the nationalism that's going on right now. So watch how the other nations react after Brexit is finalized on March 29th. Second point, see whether the U.S. pulls its military resources out of Europe. It's already being discussed. I would say it's being threatened. Sometimes if you look at how President Trump does things, he talks forcefully. He doesn't mince words. He doesn't mince words when he tweets or when he talks. And he says things that scare people, and they do. Presidents in the past have not been so forthright, and I think that what his braggadocio is scaring Europe. So does the U.S. pull its military resources out of Europe? If it does, what's going to happen, and how fast will it happen? I think you realize, as being discussed, the U.S. has told Europe that they're not paying enough for their own protection. It will force Europe to defend itself. What would a European army look like, right? If it's ethnos, you're going to have trouble getting a united army because, well, we got our way of doing things. We have breakfast at 9. Well, we have breakfast at 6:30. Well, you know, you can just see the tensions that are going to – something has to happen to cause this. With no U.S. presence, will there be a further Islamic push into Europe? I think absolutely. And, in fact, that's prophetic. The King of the South is going to continue to push against Europe. They're already doing it. If the United States isn't there to help – then that's going to be open borders for them. It's already a sore spot with many Europeans and a precursor to the King of the South. The third thing, see if the U.S. pulls its military out of the Arab states. That is also being discussed, right? If the United States pulls itself out of Afghanistan, out of Iran, out of Syria, out of Lebanon, that will allow the King of the South to become a stronger principle in and of and by itself. At some point in time, a king must arise in the South. It doesn't say a group of nations. It says the king of the South, the Basileos. There is a person that is going to rule over the Arab states. They will all have to give their authority, as it would be, to a caliphate. And if you've never studied that word, that's a good caliphate. That's what you can look through history and see that the king of the South always came in under a caliphate. There was always a ruler that ruled over the Arab states. Many are already calling for a united Arab caliphate to be resurrected. Without the U.S., will the Arab states finally enhance their military? So that's the third thing. Watch and see if the U.S. pulls out of the Arab states. And finally, point four, watch for a strong man to arise in both Europe and in the Arab states. There will be a king of the north. There will be a king of the south. At some point in time, a ruler is going to have to arise in both. Because it's not going to be an ethnos. It's not going to be a national thing. It's going to be a basileus. It's going to be a king that rules. Prophecy indicates there will be one in each. It is more than just a collection of states. Both of them have to submit to a leader. I want to end in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, this is something that Jesus Christ said at the end of the Olivet prophecy when he talked about when the disciples wanted to know what was going to happen, and he was saying there will be wars and rumors of wars. Ethnos will fight ethnos. Basileus will fight Basileus. There will be earthquakes. There will be things happen. Verse 32, this is how he ends the discussion of end time events. Verse 32, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and shoots forth leaves, you know that summer is near. Marlis and I were talking about that on the way up today. The red buds are starting to bud. You know that spring is just around the corner. Even though it was a little damp and a little chilly today, you can tell by the trees that spring is coming. That's what Jesus is saying here. Know that summer is near. Verse 33, so you also, when you see these things, all that he talked about up here, ethnos against ethnos, Basileus against Basileus, this thing starting to happen in the Middle East, know that it is near even at the doors. Surely I say unto you, this generation will by no means pass away. Once this starts, once you see all this come down in Europe, once you see King of the South and the King of the North, it's not going to go on for hundreds of years. This is going to happen quick. They're going to give their power 1 hour with the beast. The beast will end up destroying the papacy. This is all going to happen very quickly. This generation will by no means pass away till all this is done. This will happen quick. Heaven and earth could pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. In other words, Jesus Christ is saying, this is going to happen, and you need to be watching. Brethren, we need to keep our eyes on the Middle East and on Europe, on the various things that happen that we sometimes don't see. If you want to read more about this, by the way, the Life, Hope, and Truth website has got two really good articles written about the Élysée Treaty and about what's happening in Europe right now. Would be a good read for you. Keep your eyes on the Middle East.